This is Bad Movies We Love, part of the Scheist Podcast Network.
If you're listening to this, you are the resistance.
Hello, bad movie lovers, and welcome back to Bad Movies We Love. I am your host, Nick Scheist,
the master of the stupid stuff.
I've got a surprise for you. We are doing things a little bit differently today as I welcome you to the very first spotlight session here on Bad Movies We Love, where we don't just talk about movies, we talk to the people who make them. In this Filmmaker in Focus episode, I sat down with Carl Huber, the special effects guru and the director of The Broadcast, Zero Hour, Dorset, Amy's House of Art, and the upcoming Four Vacancies. We discuss filmmaking inspirations, getting started in the business, the unparalleled benefits of trial and error, genre diversity, filmmaking in Florida, and fundraising efforts for his new horror comedy project. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the very first Spotlight Session episode here at Bad Movies We Love. Carl, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here. This is kind of an anomaly for Bad Movies We Love. We usually do the director interviews elsewhere, but you reached out to me. I'm glad you're here.
Thank you. Yeah, glad to be here. I've looked into the to your site, followed you on the page there. I'm not intentionally trying to make a bad movie here, but I do like watching a lot of bad movies, especially the very B-rated, just poorly made ones. They're better on Tubi, Trauma.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah, so I'm a,
I know them well. You know, I watched The Broadcast, so I feel like I can confidently say that you're not trying to make a bad movie here. So we're not trying to lead the audience in that direction. We're here to talk about a new project that you're working on. But because this is the show, I'm going to fold in some other sort of bad movie questions in there for you. But in terms of this project for Vacancies, what started this? Where did it come from?
It really started because I do photography as well. And when I first started out back in like 2018, I had this idea for, well, I guess not really an idea, but just, you know, the nude girl, the naked bloody girl in the bathtub, or just photo shoots where she's just naked, covered in blood. I just wanted to do something like that in a very gothic, gritty kind of a way. So, you know, found the model, we did that. And I don't know why, but first off, you could post stuff like that, implied nudity on Facebook at the time. Like Facebook groups, the horror groups loved it. They all took it, no issues. Now it's a completely different story. But I don't know why I thought I couldn't just post this hot naked girl covered in blood on Facebook and just without a story. But I wrote some article about this demonic entity that's been checking, going from motel to motel, pretty much just picking up people, killing them. And, you know, the article was extensive. When I posted it, I just thought, like, why did I write that? Like, of course people just want to see the naked girl. So I expected just a bunch of perverted comments, and there were. But there was also a lot of people who were just engaged with that article and like really thought this was a movie or wanted it to be a movie. So, you know, I tried spinning several different stories about this and finally just settled on a comedic one about a degenerate delivery driver who thinks he's just, you know, delivering to the fantasy girl of his dreams, only to find out that she's this shape-shifting succubus. And then the rest of the film is three more rooms with their own situation that are all kind of tied into that. Same motel, same night. So it's just all practical effects, very wild, very outrageous. I do want to do it in a very well-made way, but also have that same kind of gritty, comical, the horror special effects edge to it that are in the bad movies, but just more out there.
Yeah, and I think obviously you have a love for makeup design and practical effects work. So I'm curious, where does that come from? Like, where did that start for you?
I've just been a huge fan of horror films ever since I was a kid. You know, I'm just, yeah, I'd stay up until like 2 o'clock in the morning because that's when they showed all the Friday the 13th films and just all the horror movies on USA and TNT. And then, you know, wake up at 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning, tired as hell to go to school just so I can do it all over again. But oddly enough, special effects was not something I ever saw myself getting into. Filmmaking is what I wanted to do. Once I finally started getting, you know, money to buy camera equipment, horror was the only genre that I really knew or that I knew would get out there as far as festival purposes. But I didn't know any special effects artists. So I just looked up YouTube, how to make, you know, cuts, wounds, bought a silicone kit. Once I figured out how to do that, just kept on watching YouTube videos, how to make how to light cast, how to make hands, how to do this thing. And eventually you run out of videos on YouTube. So you do have to start workshopping your own ideas. Like bullet squibs. You ever see the exploding blood blood packs in the movie where someone gets shot? Well, they have plenty of ones where it's like blood tubing and CO2. It takes 15, 20 minutes to set up. Anything can go wrong. Like the tubing can move away from the perforated hole. So instead of blood coming out here, you just have blood spraying out that way. So I learned how to make the exploding ones just by months of trial and error, because they don't have that on YouTube. They would essentially be teaching you how to make a bomb.
But
it just keeps growing. Like I'm still learning stuff.
And how old were you when you started first like dabbling in making your own special effects?
I think I was around 28.
That's cool. I mean, it's good to know that you can just go on YouTube and begin to like teach yourself a skill and develop it to the point where you've now surpassed the knowledge base that you can find online and you're sort of flying blind. But it's very much like a trial by fire in that way.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, for filmmaking or photography, I would suggest not even going to school because it feels like the schools teach you this textbook way of doing things. As to where if you learn it online or just the basics online and then just kind of work as you go, you can develop your own craft as opposed to them telling you, no, that's wrong. You have to do it this way. So, yeah, don't go to school, kids.
Well, fortunately, there's not too many kids that are going to listen to this show anyway. But when you were making your first project, and that was the feature, right? The broadcast.
Was that the second one?
There was a short before that.
There was a few shorts before that. They were all on my YouTube video that ended up getting permanently deleted back in 2021. To this day, I still don't know why. There were short films that was on a previous hard drive that crashed. And I was like, you know, it's on YouTube. It's fine. It's going to be there forever. And 2021 comes around. I get a message from YouTube and they're like, hey, by the way, we just permanently deleted your channel for posting, repeatedly posting sexual content and nudity. And I was like, none of my shit has nudity. It's all like special effects stuff, short films. So I tried appealing it 11 times and I got the same AI response back saying that we reviewed your things. So I just started a new channel, but, I made about 3 other short films that were not great before I did the broadcast.
I looked for Zero Hour and that was one that was
redirected me to Facebook and then told me that the YouTube channel was no longer there.
Zero Hour is on my new YouTube channel. I can send you a link to that one. But yeah, that one, back in those days, I was trying to do more dramatic stuff. So the broadcast is a dramatic thriller, which I thought, you know, it's about the 1938 War of the Worlds radio play. And I thought, like, okay, everybody wants... There was one movie in the 1970s about it. It wasn't great. It had way too many characters. Just, it's hard to focus on the actual play itself. So I thought that would be a good way to get out there. And turns out no one even gives a shit about that play anymore, at least not the younger generation.
That's fair. I mean, I'm a little bit older, so when I watched it, I felt like it was a good use of the radio drama in terms of sort of using that narrative against the story that you're playing in the foreground, but also with that, you get to dabble in like some black and white. There's some silent filmmaking in there. So I think you get to like stretch your legs in a couple of different directions with that, that I found pretty interesting. And I was just curious, like in your approach to making that, what did you learn from that doing like a first time feature that you're bringing into this new one?
A lot of things. That one, for one, if you're going to bring film, if you're going to bring your friends into the filmmaking experience, make sure they're dedicated to the process. Just because I had a couple of friends that I brought in who just, they fucked around and honestly pissed everyone off. They got on my nerves. I stopped talking to them after that. Like people I'd known for years. Just because of how blatantly disrespectful they were being to the entire, because I prepped for about a year putting that film together. And I maxed out a bunch of credit cards to make it. And I really, I guess for one, is I did have a storyboard, but it was just a bunch of pictures, not really organized. You know, it was organized to the script page, but there wasn't really any notes there or anything. So now I kind of do things in a graphic novel sort of approach. Like I draw the storyboard and I put a box for the characters' actions, cinematographer, what they need, lighting, special effects. And it's just a lot more organized. And I see it on sets. There's plenty of sets that don't use this method. And it's just chaos. They always run behind schedule. They have to compromise shots just because the director, you know, no matter how well they can articulate things, somebody just isn't understanding it. So you need time to get that out there. So, yeah.
Well, listening to the answer to the earlier question about like the development of the story for Four Vacancies and that starting from like a series of photo shoots, are you a visual thinker in the idea that like you see the scene that you already have in your head and you write it out from there?
Yes, definitely. Not only do I write it, but well, getting back to Zero Hour, when I was writing the script to that, I was drawing the storyboard at the same time. Like, as I'm writing it, I got my sketch pad with me, just drawing everything out, because that's how it was running in my head. Just, I didn't want to, like, forget anything, just get it on there. So, I think that script and the storyboard took about 10 days to develop, but it still took 9 months to shoot the film, because the casting, really. I wanted to, it centers around a woman who believes aliens are an alien she met 20 years prior is coming to take her to a new planet. But now she has a 5-year-old daughter and doesn't know if the daughter's going to be able to go with her or not. And this is the last, it's counting down the hours before the alien is supposed to get there. So 9 months before we even started filming that, I already had the actress, but needed to find a little girl that looked exactly like her. And surprisingly, found her on the first attempt.
Oh, wow. So, okay.
Yeah, got lucky there.
Yeah, good luck. In terms of, like, the overall process, where are you in that process for four vacancies right now? I know that the Kickstarter is on schedule to launch, but hasn't quite launched at the time of this recording.
Yeah, we're hoping to get it launched in late June or early July. I'm just trying to get the word out there. I'm just using several different methods, mainly meta ads, to just collect leads, followings to the actual Kickstarter campaign. Most of the time when Kickstarters or Indiegogos fail, it's because somebody just made the page and launched it. And maybe shared it with friends. Like, they didn't, you have to do a pre-launch. Otherwise, unless you're just raising a few hundred dollars, it's going to fail because no one knows about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what's the biggest hurdle right now in getting this project off the ground? Is it word of mouth? Is it just financing? Are you still like, is casting an issue for you at this point?
Not so much casting. Really just the financing at this point, the actual know-how, making the special effects. As of right now, I'm currently just writing out storyboard while getting the word out there every day. Just with any minute I can get, like, I'm just on my computer, just meta ads, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, just throwing it out there. So right now it's just the financing. If we can't get that, then the film just doesn't happen, pretty much. But I've been working on this film for about 6 years now.
Oh, wow.
3 years. Like I said, the entire film takes place on the same night, and it's essentially all happening around the same time. So it took about 3 years to actually map out that script, like how you cover four different events happening in four different rooms in the same time. So, yeah, that was tricky. But everything's good. People have read the scripts, loved it. It's just no one has money. So,
welcome to the club.
yeah.
So I saw that the pitch video, you know, sort of suggested this is a cross between like Bad Times at the El Royale sort of meets Creepshow. And I watched Amy's House of Art, which I liked and had a very sort of light comedy touch to it, even though it has some pretty gnarly, like, practical effects to it. It seems like this project is going to be, I think, decidedly darker, if not like completely dark.
It is actually just going to be darker. The comedy just comes from like how fucked up it is, because I'm not really a fan of intentional comedy. When movies, I guess a good example is, you know, Boondock Saints. The scenes that were funny, they weren't actually funny. These guys were putting themselves in danger. It was just bad luck that they ended up getting out of. And the comedy just comes from bad decisions. They're not really trying to be funny, as opposed to the sequel set 10 years later. It just seems like everyone got dumber from the first movie. They're just acting like the Three Stooges. Everything is just trying to be a joke. Just nothing landed with that sequel, because they were just trying to make an intentional comedy. So this one, there's not really any jokes in it. The humor just comes from the intensity of the situation, I guess, best way to explain it.
No, I understand that. I think like situational comedy is a different muscle to flex, because you're not necessarily writing punchlines. It's more about like tone and tension throughout the film that sort of just allows the comedy to come to the surface.
Yeah, there's a lot of elements you have to deal with there. Like Amy's House of Arts, it was the music, just the structure, I guess, because it starts off like, is this girl just fucking with us?
Yeah.
Because we start seeing minor art pieces. And as we go further into the back of the house is when it gets progressively more and more fucked up. So, yeah, just something like that. It's not intentionally trying to be funny. We're just showing this person's daily routines. And she thinks it's completely okay. It's normal.
Yeah, sort of like the expectation versus the reality, and that we're seeing this as like, oh, this is kind of like a YouTube featurette, but this person's a psychopath, sort of like in the vein of like a Bucket of Blood. And for some reason, she's growing a ton of corn in her backyard, which I found it was like perfect.
That was, I guess the origin story of how that film came. I moved into this house and I like planting stuff. So I was living in apartments for years, moved into this house. The first thing I wanted to do was plant a bunch of corn in the backyard. So that's what I did. I just planted a bunch of corn in the backyard. And then I joined this film challenge called the Creature Feature Challenge, where you had 2 weeks to make a short horror film. From start to finish, they picked the creature and the genre and entered that. The creature was innocently evil and the genre was mockumentary.
Oh, okay.
So I almost didn't do it because I wanted something more intense where I could like have some cinematography with, you know, really fucked up special effects, like a vampire thing. Then I started walking around my house and, you know, I got faces on the wall, just stuff that I'd made. And I was like, okay, this looks like a serial killer lives here. Lauren, the actress in there. I worked with her a couple of times and she said she had wanted to play more villainous characters because she's always like the innocent sleuth girl, or just, you know, she's just very innocent in all of her characters. So I wrote out the script, sent it to her, and I think a few days later we were just filming that. And yeah, the special effects you see at the end, pretty much all done by me. I had like one person helping me throughout this entire thing. So yeah, still, it was a tiring experience, but pretty fun.
Yeah, it looked like it was really fun to make. And you said Lauren was her name?
Yeah, Lauren Crandall. She's actually doing like the Carnival Cruise circuit now. She's one of the performers on that thing. She's been doing that for years, so.
She was good in the lead because, like you said, she still plays that sort of innocent, bubbly friend kind of character. But then she's murdering people and doesn't seem to have an issue with it. I really liked it.
And you got the light music in the background. But, you know, the comedy comes from just the music and her attitude. But the reality is this is a deeply disturbed psychotic person. If you get anywhere near her, you're fucking dead, which is why I was also filming it. I have a gimbal for smooth motion, but I decided to go handheld just to get that jerky motion of like the camera guy being afraid of being around her.
Yeah, it worked. I thought it was pretty clever. But in terms of, I guess, maybe your inspirations, right? Like, who are some filmmakers or creatives that have informed your style?
I would say Orson Welles, definitely.
I can see that.
Which is, yeah, that was one of the things. I really wanted to do an homage to him when he did the War of the Worlds radio broadcast. First, that guy has an extremely deep, but he was only 23 years old when he did that. And he's like baby face, but his voice is like really deep. And just, yeah. But it's also just his filmmaking, you know. I don't know. He, looking at his films now, like a lot of people really thought he was a genius, but at the time, nobody was doing this.
Yeah.
You know, the camera angles, the wide angles, fish eyes. So he would be pissing off executive producers left and right because they wanted it done this way and he was just doing it his way. But yeah, he's definitely one of them. M. Night Shyamalan, you know, he is also another one, at least starting out, really cared about details in the films. The Sixth Sense, Unbreakable. I mean, I could go on for hours about the stuff he was doing in Unbreakable, how the entire film just kind of feels like you're watching a comic book come to life. Really just stuff like that. James Cameron being another one. Guillermo del Toro at the beginning, because he was also a director and special effects artist. But yeah, those kind of inspirations.
So with you growing up being a fan of horror films and the horror genre, I guess what are the films that were like your go-tos? Was it all B-movie stuff at the time? Were you into slashers? Because I know a lot of films from the 70s and 80s, really, like, even when they were maybe not being good films anymore in the franchise, the emphasis on having good practical effects, I think, was the through line for those franchises, even like maybe well beyond like what would be the expiration date.
Yeah. The expiration date as far as when CGI came in, or did those special effects like hold up over the years?
Well, I was more referring to like a franchise that's now in installment number 7, you know, the Hellraiser is in like number 7 or 8, right? It kind of like, it was a really good franchise for the first few films, and then they got less money to make the sequel, and less money to make the sequel, less money to make the sequel. But what always stayed consistent with those movies was the adherence to practical effects and stuff like that being the core of what made those movies entertaining.
I see what you're saying. Actually, I think with Hellraiser, I think they're on like the 16th film now.
Yeah, I was being generous.
Growing up, yeah, like Hellraiser, it was really just the mainstream horror stuff. We had basic cable growing up, so it's not like they were just gonna, you know, you see a Dario Argento film on USA or something like that. It was just very much Nightmare, you know, Friday, Halloween,
yeah,
Hellraiser, stuff like that. Very toned down, just for the centuries. I kind of got desensitized with slashers right around the time Scream came out. Because they were all just following that same formula plot. And I don't know, after the 80s, when the 90s came in, they were just really toning down on just everything. The violence, the nudity in films. They were just, when you watch Scream again, it's all really just implied kills. You'll see like the aftermath, like, barely see a knife going. I think you see a knife going into Drew Barrymore in the beginning, and that's about it. The rest of it is you see a knife go up in the air and comes back up. It's got blood on it. So, and just, they kept doing that. I think it was, maybe 2010s area when they started bringing violence back into mainstream stuff. And now it's just gotten out there even further with Terrifier and stuff like that. But yeah, I liked watching the B movie stuff because yeah, they didn't give a shit. Like, they didn't have financial boundaries. They didn't have to answer to anyone, executive producers, none of that stuff. Like, it was bad. The acting was terrible. It was normally shot on a VHS or a high 8, you know, camera. But I don't know. There was something entertaining about it, at least to me. Like, you knew what you were watching. Yeah. This was not going to be a film that was going to change your life. It was just there to occupy some empty space in your life. So, you know, and if you, every once in a while, they did kick out a pretty cool kill scene.
And is there like a movie that you like watch and you're like, I know this movie is bad, like maybe the writing sucks, the acting sucks, but you just love it for what it is?
God, there's actually a lot, especially during the Halloween season when I'm working in the studio. throw on Tubi or Trauma or something like that. They're just, you know, there's these people are still pumping them out. We even have a few production companies here in Florida where they just, they constantly, they make about 7, 8, 10 films a year. They film them probably in like 4 or 5 days, entire feature films.
Oh, wow.
And it's just, yeah, like, but it's, you know, at best, it's mediocre. Because it's done in 4 or 5 days. Like, how much are you, how much consistency are you really getting out of that when you're trying to do it that way? So it's just not a very coherent film is what you're watching when you do it that way.
So what is the state of like filmmaking accessibility like in the Florida area right now?
Not great. We lost tax incentives back in 2012.
Oh, man.
So, yeah. And I think 3 years later, because there used to be a lot of Florida was one of the I think it was the third most the third highest state that had filmmaking done where people would just come to shoot a film here. Even if the setting was in Florida, you know, they would just make it flow like a tropical jungle or something. Yeah. And just shoot that on a beach in Florida. Yeah. And now we have films that are literally set in Florida, but they're being filmed in South Carolina because South Carolina has better film incentives. Yeah, we don't have anything. If something is being filmed here, it's through something called brand integration. And these are really just like the Hallmark and Lifetime movies you're seeing on TV. Corporate companies that advertise on TV will pretty much pay to have these films made. Papa John's is going to give them $75,000 to make this film. And then all the, yeah, these films are really only made for about $250,000. Wow. You know, you get like a former A-lister, like Lindsay Lohan will probably be in these films. Because they only have to pay her, you know, $800,000 a day to be on set. But as far as horror goes, we don't have, there's no support there whatsoever. You have to go to the crowdfunders, or you just have to know someone who's rich and willing to do that. That's what LA is actually like that now, from what I hear. California, they did away with the film incentives too. And LA is a lot more stricter from what I hear when it comes to making a film there. Like you need permits to do anything.
Yeah, pretty much. And a lot of that legislation has driven people away. And that's why there's a lot more filming in like Georgia, South Carolina, a lot of shows that are LA based film in like Vancouver. So,
yeah.
A lot of that has happened here, and I've got friends in the industry that are definitely impacted by that. So it's tough to see, especially because like LA is like it's the movie town, or at least, you know, historically, we shouldn't be losing production in that way.
Yeah. When did that happen, by the way? When did you guys lose incentives over there?
It definitely got worse post pandemic. Where like it's just hard to get anything made, and it's like the studios are full but don't see stuff filming out on the streets as much as we used to. I mean, obviously if it's a big production that has money, they're still going to come in and do it, but there's also way fewer shows that are filming like 26 episode series now, so you're not even getting that kind of filming around the town anymore.
Yeah, I have actually noticed that a lot of TV shows have kind of like cut their episodes in half per season now, as opposed to, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah. You had mentioned brand integration as something that is helping get films made. So I'm curious. Number one, you mentioned Papa John's. You've got a pizza guy in your movie. I'm not saying that, like, get Papa John's to sponsor that, but in terms of, like, how films get funded now, like, are you at the point where you need to sort of, like, reach out to brands in order to maybe, like, help bridge the gap between what you can raise and what you need?
I definitely looked into that, and honestly, I want to say 30, 40 years ago, that would have been the case. When brand integration first, well, I mean, it's always been there. But when they started doing it with movies, I guess back in the 70s and 80s, corporate stuff like Dunkin' Donuts, KFC, Papa John's, you know, Marlboro cigarettes, just anything that's a franchise or corporate would throw their stuff in anything. But after research and reviews, and, you know, they look at the data on what did well and what didn't, horror movies did not do well. So let's say there was one, Swiss Army Man. Have you heard of that?
Oh, yeah. I love that movie.
Hostess, they reached out to all of those people. And Hostess was the only one who gave them any money to let them show their brand. But that's only because Hostess was literally dying again. Mm. But all the other, when you pitch these people, because I did try this, it didn't work. When you pitch these people, you can only do a 2-paragraph thing and just to sell your movie. And a movie about a guy finding a dead talking farting corpse just doesn't really sell, get these people to want to buy into your film and have.
So I want to give you a chance to talk about, you know, what you are hoping to get out of the Kickstarter, because I mean, I have the page up so I can see it, but I think it's better coming from you. Of course, I'm going to include the links for this and for the short films that are included as well in the show notes for this episode, so people can check out your work just with a click of a button. But yeah, tell us about, like, you know, what you want to get out of the Kickstarter, what you're offering.
Well, right now the biggest offer is, like I said, I do photography, and it's mostly horror, gothic, erotic type stuff. There is stuff with wardrobe concepts in it, but it's just, I've been doing it mainly as a hobby and also kind of just to build up my social media pages before, you know, Facebook and Instagram started losing their shit about just the smallest bit of implied nudity. But I have you know, cosplay photo shoots. There's a Patreon page for it now, uncensored. It shows not only the photo shoots, but there's also time lapse behind the scenes, how special effects are done, what cameras, lenses, lighting techniques. So even if you aren't going there just to perv on all the models, you can still learn. There's a lot to learn special effects. And if you are trying to get into photography, you can learn about, you know, the type of gear, lenses, lighting equipment. That way you're not spending thousands of dollars on shit you don't need at first, like I did. But yeah, for $25 is one of the perks. They get a 1-year free subscription to that, which is honestly just an awesome perk. Like right now it's $7 a month. So $25, they get free unlimited access. We have a... coming back to brand integration, if you do have a product or something you want to promote, or just even a website, social media, we do have a, I don't want to say segment, but there is kind of a spot in there with one of the characters where you can get that out there. I don't have that number up on me. I know it's on the pre-launch, but yeah, there's just, you know, cheaper tiers, you know, you want a copy of the scripts or just a digital link, or yeah, digital file of the film when it first comes out. I think those are around $10, $15, $20. then you have the higher perks, producer, executive producer. If you want to spend the day on sets, I'm going to be adding more stuff on there, like special effects, tutorial packages for anyone wanting to get into that game. Also, discount links to my Etsy page. We got Halloween season coming up soon. So, well, cosplay Halloween season. So if you want discounts on teeth, mask, props, prosthetics, there'll be a tier for that. And yeah, just also description of the film, what it's about, pretty much just this roller coaster gore ride, basically.
That sounds fun. I know there's a lot of fans that are big fans of the horror genre specifically for the gore elements and the practical effects. I mean, I know a lot of these people personally, so I think I can speak to a desire to still see this kind of stuff put to film. I'm looking, though, one of the perks is $50 for a Blu-ray copy and film poster once the movie is complete. So for something like the Blu-ray, like, where does that come into the process, like, once the film is finished?
When the film is, they do have, what is it, backer kits, mm-hmm. is what they're called, and it's kind of just a funnel of getting things mass-produced, like DVDs, VHSs, Blu-ray copies. You can either pay somebody to design the cover and stuff like that. I usually do this all myself anyway. The Kickstarter page was made by me, the concept art, all of that. But yeah, you can either, you know, throw somebody a few hundred dollars. I don't know the actual price off the top of my head. They'll design the cover for you. You submit that into the company who, you know, send them the file of the film, cover art. They, you know, make 500 Blu-rays, charge whatever that is with a bulk discount rate. And when you make those perks, you just have to kind of factor that price into the perk of the tier. So I would say for $50, that's probably going to 25 of that's going to the film. 25 of that is probably going to, you know, Kickstarter's fee, and then you have the manufacturing of a Blu-ray and poster.
Gotcha. And it looks like at the lower level, at least, it says if you donate 20, you get the $10 perk. So does that stack as you go up to, like, if you donate the 50, you also get the lower tiers, or no?
For the most part, I think after $40, it kind of branches out as to what you'll get.
Gotcha. Okay.
But anyone, the main thing, the $25 Nocturnal Dreams Patreon page, that's going to everyone who donates above $25, no matter what. I think even the script and the digital copy is pretty much sewn into all the perks as well. But as you go up higher, those perks are still there, but other perks are just kind of like, you know, handpicked to sort of tailor to that perk.
Gotcha.
But executive producer would get all of those perks, with the exception of producer and stuff like that, because they're already executive producer. They don't need that producer credit. Yeah.
Because this is in pre-launch right now, I don't see... I don't think I see the goal listed. Do you know already what that number is in mind that you're looking to crowdfund?
Right now we have, it was there at first, but right now we're at $250,000. And like I said, depending on where we are with leads and followers at the time of launch, I have to be flexible with that goal.
Yeah.
Because I'm putting a lot of money into the campaign itself right now, just with getting leads. Like, I'm maxing out credit cards just to do this. So at the end of the day, I don't want to, if I fall short, because I have looked up how many leads you would need to actually fulfill that 250 grand. So if I fall short of those leads by the time we launch, I'm going to have to just lower that and just kind of hope that the rest of it, like if I have to lower it to 150, 200 grand, just hope that there's excessive donors after we meet that goal that brings it up to that 250 or possibly more.
Yeah. And is this something where you maybe shoot like some concept footage to then show? Or, you know, I've heard of examples of that in the past where it's like there was a little bit of funding up front, some things got shot, you use that as proof of concept.
I've heard of that, and I've been a part of those proof of concepts. And the thing is, getting back to why Kickstarters fail, is people do these proof of concepts, or they make a really good page. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but it's their opinion. But no matter how good the page is, how good the proof of concept is, and the fact that we're in Florida, you know, you're not going to show that proof of concept to investors and get them to invest in Florida, especially for a horror film. So crowdfunding is, you know, a last resort there. And if you don't do the pre-launch, everything you just did, you know, if you paid $10,000, $15,000 to make that proof of concept, that's all it is. You can show it to, and that's kind of what happens is these people show it to festivals, or they just have it as an unlisted YouTube link. That they still, 10 years later, you know, proof of concepts that I worked on, still nothing. Like they did a failed Indiegogo or Kickstarter, and yeah, they didn't do the pre-launch stuff, so it failed.
That's a tough needle to thread. For the people that are listening and like considering, or that will consider, you know, signing up to be part of the Kickstarter, where primarily does the budget get allocated? So like, say you raise your money, like where does that money go? Is that for securing sets? Is that paying the cast? Is that licensing?
Pretty much all of that. Licensing, legal, there's insurance needed, cast. If you're working with SAG or non-SAG members, like union actors, preferably, it would be best not to work on union sets because there is a lot more red tape and just legal bullshit you have to go through. And those are just confusing nightmares. But the good thing about horror is that you really don't need well-known talent. You just need like a, you know, Terrifier or the Winnie the Pooh film, which honestly, I mean, that right there was a bad movie. But it made
Blood and Honey, yeah.
Yeah, but I think it made around $7 million in box office.
It was
a $100,000 film. What was it? In a Violent Nature, I think, was more of a critical thing. I think it was box. I don't think it did that well in box office. In a Violent Nature. Where the point of view of the serial killer. That even had some like really good practical effect kills in there.
Yeah, very much so.
But yeah, I don't think that one, despite all of its hype, it's one of those weird films where everyone knows about it, but it still did not do well in box office.
Yeah, I think it did like really well among sort of like hardcore horror enthusiasts that are really big into the practical effects. And then I think wider audiences just it didn't translate.
Yeah, like, you know, Terrifier 2, I think that made $16 million in box office.
Yeah, I think Terrifier 3 when it came out was number one for a while, did really well. So there's definitely a market for it out there. With looking at, I guess, your schedule, when is the actual launch for the Kickstarter?
If I had to pin a date on it, I would say June 28th.
End of the month.
Yes, at the end of the month. just to like pinpoint where in my head the 28th would be a good time. But like I said, it could hover maybe a week after that. It just, like I said, I don't want to launch this thing until I have the pre-support that I'm just desperately trying to scoop up every single day. But it is getting there. We're about 2,000 email leads in. I'm currently I spent most of my time focusing on just email leads, and then I found out that if you go to the actual pre-launch page, you can follow that, and getting pre-launch followers it's kind of a toss-up right now. I'm hearing that leads are better, followers are better, so I did focus on the leads. Now I'm trying to get more followers, so I'm just trying to get that number up there.
Cool. Well, I will do my best to make sure that number gains traction. The link, of course, for the Kickstarter and all that stuff is going to be in the show notes for this episode. I've asked you everything that I really wanted to ask you. Is there anything that you wanted to add to the conversation before we wrap it up?
I mean, I did have a question, but is that like the normal background that you have there, or is that just something?
No, because you're doing four vacancies, I always sort of like pick a themed background based on what I'm talking about.
I thought it at first, but I was like, that kind of looks like it can go well with any sort of horror film genre, really. It's a shady looking motel.
As long as my head's in the way, it doesn't even say motel. Thank you for that. This has been a fascinating conversation. Like I said, I did what I could to watch what I could of yours. I liked the broadcast. I liked Amy's House of Art. I feel they're very different projects tonally, of course. I mean, they're not operating on the same wavelength, but I think what it shows is that you're able to do a lot of different things, and you're not necessarily like pigeonholed into being like this kind of filmmaker, that kind of filmmaker.
Yeah, I definitely, if I ever do actually start getting paid to make films, I definitely want to be able to branch out to other things, not just horror, but just dramas or actions and, you know, comedies, hell, maybe even romance, who knows. But horror is just, it's fun, you know, like
it is.
There's no debate. There's no like hard discussions about it. You watch it, and yeah, it's just entertaining.
It seems like it's a genre that's never really gone out of style. It's kind of changed its approach over the years. Like, you know, you mentioned Scream, and that sort of led into the 2000s era style of horror film, which was like The Final Destinations, I Know What You Did Last Summer. And now those films, 20 plus years later, are all coming back for legacy sequels. So, you know, one way or another, horror is going to stick around forever.
It is, but we definitely need some new ideas. I mean, the new Final Destination was great, but it's just, you know, the Hellraiser thing as well. I mean, I get why they're doing that. That's a licensing thing.
Yeah,
that's why they keep pumping out shitty Hellraiser movie every 2 or 3 years, because that's how they renew the license and keep the rights. But yeah, you know, Freddy, Jason, Halloween, I think they're trying to make all of those into a series now. Mm. Yeah, so people just need to sit down in a room and just kind of come up with the next big horror thing. We can still have that stuff, but just, you know, have something for the next decade or so.
Well, then let me ask you this. Is there something that you've seen in the last couple of years that's been an original horror film that you really felt was like the direction that might be able to lead the genre like into the future?
A new horror film? I mean, I would probably say Terrifier is definitely opening some doors. As far as what it brings, you know, genre wise, Killer Clown, but it upped the ante on the violence, especially what they're allowed to show in theaters. Like, I honestly, I think COVID was also the reason for that film's success, because the theaters just needed to get more people into the theaters. And before then, you had the MPAA, like, this film could not be NC-17. It needed to have a rating. You know, rated G from R. If it's NC-17, we'll let it into a couple of theaters, but that's it. But now they're just letting anything in. I don't think Terrifier was even rated. It just went in there as unrated. And I think Three from Hell was also unrated, but it was only allowed in select theaters for like 3 days. And that's it. But COVID and Terrifier just kind of like opened the door for people who want to make more, who just want to push that envelope of, you know, just graphic violence, especially done practical wise. So I think that's what we probably have. That's probably what we're going to start seeing now, not only with just horror, but also probably with action and maybe even drama or comedies. We're just going to see like the graphic violence just kind of get up there.
Yeah. I mean, it was successful. I don't see any reason for Terrifier to stop at number 3, or at least for Damien to like leave working on like those kinds of projects.
I think they are going to stop at 4. At least that's the news I heard. I don't know. Has he, everything I've looked into about him, it's pretty much just Art the Clown based. Like All Hallows Eve was Art the Clown. So I don't know. It'd be nice to see if he's got other ideas out there after he finishes off the Terrifier series.
And he might be in a position to, you know, now that he has a film that he can make for low money and have good returns, might be able to get a little bit bigger studio involvement if that's something that he ultimately wants.
I mean, I think Terrifier 3 made $84 million worldwide. So
it was crazy impressive.
Depending on how he did that distribution deal, he might not actually need any kind of studio backing or anything.
Yeah, make whatever he wants to make at this point.
Yeah, it just depends on how much of that money went into his pocket.
Yeah. Well, it has been a pleasure talking to you. It's been really fascinating. Got to sort of pick your brain on just the business itself and this upcoming project. So thank you for your time.
It's been awesome, man. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for the very first Spotlight session here on Bad Movies We Love. And a huge thanks to Carl for sharing his time and his stories with us today. You can find more of his work at Crimson Hands FX. That's the letters FX on Instagram and on Twitter. And make sure to check out the Kickstarter, which is in the countdown phase. I'm going to make sure that all of that stuff is up for you in the show notes, easily accessible, just a click away. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to follow the show, leave us a review and a rating if you have the time, and share it with your fellow bad movie lovers. And until next time, keep loving what others might leave behind.